We are the guns on your masters, saw you our flashes. Heard you the screams of our shells in the night and the shuddering crashes. Saw you our work by the roadside, where the shrouded things lying, moaning to God that he made them, the maimed and the dying. Husbands or sons, fathers or lovers, we break them. We are the guns.
You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke James.
And I'm George Gingell.
That poem was The Voice of the Guns by Gilbert Frankau. Last week, it was the spring of 1914, and the glass paradise was gleaming. By autumn, it had finished, and the continent had dissolved into war. For Schierbart, the war was a nightmare. While much of the nation, even avant-gardists like Tout, were swept up in the euphoria that greeted the start of the war, he fell into a deep depression. He drank himself to death, by most accounts, by October of 1915. Bruno Tout wrote to his brother that he felt like he'd been orphaned. From the little we know, the war must have passed in a sense of nervous observation and powerlessness. He worked for a little while as a conscripted munitions worker, and later in an office job in a stove factory. We know that he did everything he could to avoid being called up, calling in favours from doctors, starving himself. His intense energy was stilled. There was too little to do. A few pieces of war work, a period of introspection, waiting, of anger and self-pity. The longer the war went on, the worse it got. Food ran short as the naval blockade of German ports was established. For all that, the period is also one in which Tout began to establish a new series of utopian visions for society. These would appear in the years after the war as a series of publications: Alpine Architecture, The Disillusion of the Cities, The Earth a Good Dwelling, The Weltbaumeister, and The City Crown. The works contain new elements, but they're also, I think, very clearly children of the glass paradise of before the war. George, do you want to say anything about the experience of those years in Germany and how he would have been living?
The key thing is that any privations that Britain may have suffered were infinitely worse. Germany was completely cut off. The ships were getting through to England. They weren't getting through at all. And it was completely cut off from the world. By the winter of 1916, the nation was completely exhausted. There was no food for civilians. There was very little food for anyone. And the nation was starving. And it went on starving. Things got a little bit better or worse. But it is true to say Germany was defeated by defeating the nation. The army in the field was eventually broken, but the nation had been broken before that. The state was ruined, as were the people. Everyone was malnourished.
And I think that it's important that the experience of what they had come to then casts a pall in some way over everything which had come before.
And I'm sure we've said this before, but it's worth saying that where they'd come from was they had a lot to be proud of. They had burst into modernity over half a century or a little more and had been the leading lights, at least in some fields, of rationalism and progress. The front was distant. Germany was fighting entirely outside its borders. The country was just bled dry. The young men went off to die. All the resources of the nation went with them. Nothing was brought in. And the core, slowly, having been so vital and strong, hollowed out.
I think maybe I'll read quickly from a letter which Tout wrote to his bereaved sister-in-law after the death of her fiancé on the front, because I think that it speaks to this sense of him really not knowing what to do, what to say, or even what to think in this kind of circumstance. The great current which sweeps us along will also take you. You have made a heavy sacrifice for the benefit of the whole enterprise, and I believed that your loved one, were it possible, would say, "For this my sacrifice was not too great. I made it willingly. The might of the English must be broken, and that of the Russians too. One's feelings almost demand the complete destruction of the Cossacks. These brutes must be exterminated like beasts of prey." But then later on he says, "What is the point of fighting over the political map, where woods and rivers still remain only woods and rivers? I often ask myself, for what do we actually live and die? For art and for beauty, for every fragment of a more beautiful existence which we can realise in this miserable world of ours. You see, I am practising hate, even though my profession guides me along quite different paths."
Tout was a very conflicted man. He was always a very conflicted man. That's going to be the contradiction and confliction is going to be the theme of this episode, if there is something underneath it.
Does he believe any of the things which he's just said, all of which are contradictory?
Like most of the time with Tout, he's someone with strong feelings and a lot of ventriloquism. Like, he's ventriloquizing Schirbart or this other guy, Gustav Landauer. It feels like he's ventriloquizing a lot of the stuff going round. And he doesn't know what he feels. Like, he devotes his principal energies to scrounging letters, fake jobs, real jobs, sick notes, anything to prevent himself from getting into the war.
It's really only in 1917 that he's definitely starting to re-establish a sense of direction and purpose in terms of his own production and his own kind of agenda for his own work.
Part of the reason it might have been 1917 that he starts to have these visions of a clear future is that is the point when it is clear to anybody in Germany that the war is not going well. At the beginning, they made great progress on the verge of knocking out France, terrific victories in the east. But in 1916, it's clear there's no progress. And also in that year, hundreds of thousands of men are dying. There are battles where 30,000 people could die in a day on the battlefield. And then the next day, another 20,000. Also, this is when famine hits. Yeah. Really, the turnip winter. It's when the government starts putting rather a lot of sawdust in the bread.
Alpine architecture is made up of 30 illustrated plates, mostly watercolour, whereas the glass architecture talked about the possibility of living in the mountains, of lighting up the mountains, of making them these extraordinary coloured spectacles. In Alpine architecture, the mountains have themselves become these vast crystal cities which sit sort of flower-like on top of the peaks, and they're accompanied by a delirious poetic text.
If that doesn't seem like it's pushed far enough, he doesn't just stop at the Alps. The world and then the universe will be converted entirely into crystal, glowing crystals.
Let's start with the introduction. The Monte Rosa and its foothills down to the green plains is to be rebuilt. Yes, impractical and without utility. But have we become happy through utility? Always utility and utility. Comfort, convenience, good food, culture, knife, fork, trains, toilets, and yet also cannons, bombs, instruments of murder. To want only the utilitarian and comfortable without higher ideals is boredom. Boredom brings quarrel, strife and war. Preach the social idea. Engage the masses in a great task which fulfills everybody from the humblest to the foremost.
Something that strikes me immediately is that there is a through line with Bruno Tout's philosophy, which is that he is pretty sure that architecture can organise society. You can solve all of the problems, all of the social problems, by art.
He's trying to imagine architecture as a sort of shared project of such beauty and wonder that it can engage, inspire, and in some way sort of heal and unite the entirety of society.
Because I think for him it could, right? He's in these moments of desperation and he channels all his energy into making pretty pictures. And I think that's validating and imagining a future where the world is like that. Bruno Tout's answer, I think, to isn't this all a bit mad, would be being rational has got us into this mess in the first place. I think that is sort of what he means by always utility, utility, comfort and convenience, good food, something probably very absent.
Yeah. Alpine architecture, in common with some of the others, is a narrative in pictures in which there's a development. We could talk through some key images. We start off, as we've described, with rather lovely pink watercolour mountains with green fields sort of leading up through curving valleys. And on top of these ruby crystal structures, which are sitting and growing out of the top of them, with the sun radiating light behind them.
Yeah. The huge sun boiling up everything and filling the sky.
There are a series of kind of variations that we see. There's something called the Crystal House, which is a kind of hill fortress, a Tuscan hill town. These sort of curving dome-like accretion of forms.
Very much also the pine cone. This one is the most pine coney.
There is a long, deep valley which has been filled up by crystal bridges of prodigious size, which towards the back are kind of stacking up and almost filling the valley. And there is also something which I don't really know how to describe it. It's also almost like a kind of buried Colosseum. It's quite volval, crystal, shining thing, like buried deep in the heart of the mountains.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, you're looking at the same one.
Yeah, yeah. He's yeah. It's an interesting manifesto for a new society, because what it is, fundamentally, is a load of pretty pictures of fantasy buildings on the things that could be made of glass theme. Like, there are the big images, and then there are all these images which are sort of like architectural images, almost, like collected elevations and things. And it feels to me fantasy sketchbook. You know, you can't do something and you're sketching amazing buildings and he sketches them out and then he paints over them. And that's what the book is, with a poem. And I think that's probably the best way to look at it. I worry that we overthink. You sort of talk about these things. It's so easy to say, well, this is all nonsense. It is all nonsense. And I think it's correct to challenge the way they speak. But I think you've got to challenge it as if you were challenging your own emotions. When you're analysing works of art and literature, it's good to resist the urge to psychoanalyze. But I think here it's the other way around. You've got to psychoanalyze rather than, like, literally criticize. I was wondering, listening to the last episode, which was a harrowing experience, why we are talking about Shearbar, Tout, all these guys. Why are we so won over? There's an obvious first thought, which is that they represent a future that didn't happen. We all know we're surrounded by, I'm living in a sort of modernist block of flats. We all know the future that did happen became the modern, and the modern is everything we've formed. And this is a sort of proto-modern that is a completely different vision. But I don't think that's it. I don't think that's all of it. It's also the difference in attitude. It's the idea of the ecstatic. Although the ecstatic, there is a subconscious in the international movement, but it's very, very suppressed. Whereas this is superficially, totally ecstatic. And then he's always trying to ram in weird rationalism under the surface. He's always writing down logical arguments to justify ecstasy.
I think that its fascination is because it's a thing which has almost disappeared from our world. I think that the closest thing that we have to Bruno Tout in the present day is like Elon Musk. Like Elon Musk doing a video about going to Mars.
Well, Elon Musk is a Shearbart character. Don't you think? He's one of the Shearbart plutocrats who wants insane. Yeah. There's another thing, I think. It is a visual language. It establishes a visual language. Not just Bruno Tout, but the whole gang of them. Which nearly completely dies, but pops up in odd places. It doesn't pop up very much in architecture, but it pops up in other cultural expressions. And it's interesting to see the connections of this thing in this sort of lost strand.
From the mountains, the crystal cities go on to inhabit sequentially the Riviera. You get these peninsular crystal cities covered in these sort of shivering spines. We see them across a larger expanse of mountains, and then actually they become islands. We move outward into a kind of continental vision, seeing like the whole world, and then pulling out and out, we start to see these sort of crystalline structures at the scale of a planet, and then also somehow in the same instant as an atom.
Oh, God, I'm going to derail us a bit again. But it's ecstasy. Yeah. It's like a religious sense of how you see the world. Yeah. And that is something which all but one of the books we're going to talk about share, which is they are cascades of visions, of which word and sense are only a secondary component. It belongs much more to the ecstasy of St. Teresa, or to it's that sort of world that we reject. Like we can talk about it in the sort of hippie drug claptrap kind of world if you want, but I think it's probably more enlightening to talk about it in a way that is less like pre-framed.
We alluded to some of the other ingredients. A big one was the work of a kind of idealistic, I guess you'd call him a sort of idealistic socialist, Gustav Landauer, who wrote a book called Aufruf zum Sozialismus, Call to Socialism. At this point, we assume as a matter of course that all socialists are materialist. They may well be striving for something which seems quite utopian, which is a world where we don't have to work, a world where everyone is equal, a world like entirely without want and poverty, all of these kind of things. But we would be surprised at some of the things which Landauer included in his prospective utopia. So an idea which he had quite strongly was that the industrial cities of the 19th century, which had been created by capitalism, would be overtaken and replaced in returning to a closer relationship with the land. People would also rediscover a deeper and more profound symbolic unity with nature and with the essential and kind of healing forces of the universe. He also believed in a series of ideas which we are now much more used to hearing in a more sinister context. He believed in the idea of Geist, the unifying spirit of the people, and he believed in the people as folk, the people as a kind of a sort of mystic and symbolic unity. And it, of course, we're now used to hearing some of these ideas because of the way in which they percolated into and became integrated into the ideology of National Socialism. I'm drawing heavily here on one of our major books for today, which is Bruno Taut and the Architecture of Activism by Ian Boyd White, which I'll make a link to in the show notes. Landauer's idea of Geist, in simple terms, it is the bond which links mankind to the eternal. Landauer said, Geist is communal spirit. Geist is union, and yet freedom. Geist is human federation. Soon, we shall see it even more clearly, mankind will be seized by Geist. And wherever there is Geist, there is Volk. So Volk is the condition of humanity when it's in kind of communion and unity with Geist. Bruno Taut articulates these ideas in an architectural form in his work Die Auflösung der Städte, the dissolution of the cities. Another heavily illustrated work which depicts condition of dwelling on the land to come after the old, dirty, poisonous, warmongering cities of the 19th century have been swept away and replaced.
And it's an unusual one. There have been a few times. It's something that comes up again and again. Let's break down the city and go back to nature. We've been doing it since the ancient Greeks. But people do it in different ways. It doesn't mean these things are similar. This is not at all the way that, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright would propose it, which is a very material, we're going to make a sort of endless strip mall of America. It's not like the Victorians, we're going to go back to being Heywayne's pastoral idyll. It's something where the landscape is again transformed into giant flowers and petals. Hamlets and towns become themselves flowers. It's like we're going to transform the landscape into images of nature.
So here's an image. We see at the centre of it a series of radiating, long, low, seemingly communal buildings, which radiate out like a star or a sort of an asterisk, which is the sort of the centre of the flower. Around it are a series of overlapping circles, at the heart of each of which is a little copse-like wood, and spreading out around which are different sorts of fields. There's a single winding road which comes into the heart of the town where the buildings are, and which then snakes away over the darkly shaded hills above and below. But it's, as you say, it's literally this image of the community as a something flowering on the landscape.
The phenomenon, I suppose, of taking a diagram and turning it into a plan, something that's quite old, and something also that exists in the Garden Cities movement, which is the very much more conservative, logical precursor of this, and something that Taut had been very involved in his early days. Yeah. The sort of ideal garden city as a circle is just because of a drawing. It's because of drawing circles of like expanding interactions of people and nature and things. Yeah. But it's a really strange literalization. We're going to be like flowers, so we're going to make our towns the shape of flowers.
So the one which I've described is made up of these very commonplace kind of elements, but placed in an arrangement which makes them seem slightly fantastical. There are also drawings within the folio which are themselves much more fantastical. There's one, The Great Flower, which is a floating community in which petals curve upwards and appear to create multi-story housing underneath a sort of curving amphitheatre coming down to the centre. It seems to be modelled on a water lily, and in the centre of it is this great kind of rather phallic object, which is a kind of a tower.
Oh, yes, I remember this one now. It's a giant water lily, yeah, with a massive phallus, sort of, not necessarily, but like that sort of shape,
yeah,
floating.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do these things mean? Are there any interiors? It always seems like we're looking at these things as a floating observer.
I think it's a good point. I think there are almost no interiors at all.
He talks about interiors in the words, but he never draws them. They're not part of the thought. They're not part of the diagram. And in a sense, there's something else that you never see, which is people. This is meant to be a mold for society, but it doesn't have people. It's just an idea. Something that's really clear is that these things are dashed off. They're done really quickly. He just does them and doesn't think about them too much. But he feels he's very heartfelt.
Yes, I think it's worth stressing that he, even in like very dark days, he's extraordinarily productive. All of these, we think, were published with probably about within a year of each other.
I mean, it straddles the boundary between 1919 and 1920. Yeah. And there's lots of them. There are others that we haven't mentioned. A lot of them aren't really books, though. A lot of them are pamphlets, really.
There are some of the plates which distinctly pick up on already identified forms. There's an enormous star-shaped city, although this one distinctively has these sort of tentacle-like growths in the centre of it, and a much more organic, mutable, sort of yielding aspect. What is happiness? To this question, Tolstoy gives the answer. Happiness is living in and with nature. So we city dwellers today are all unhappy, for the enjoyment of nature is happiness just as little as the enjoyment of art is happiness. Happiness is achieved only by living in nature. Once humans find their happiness, their inner peace, through a connection to the earth, then their soul will once more be fulfilled. It will be at peace in the world, in God. Then Europe, after a long, long time, will once again have a religion. In the settlements, the urban landscape will completely disappear, and individual buildings will acquire a completely different meaning, as will the isolated large building. If we rise above the earth in a balloon, what we will see below are houses strewn about, like grains of sand, by now arranged in rows as well. The grains of sand will join together, and the higher we rise, the more they will appear like a fog, now thicker, now thinner, spreading over the green countryside. And in this fog, a few glistening spots sparkle, smaller and larger, like stars in the sky. It is the places of worship erected in glass, illuminating the night. They bloom here and there like rare and precious flowers. The stars in the sky and the stars on earth greet each other.
Lovely poetic image. What he's actually describing is funnily like Frank Lloyd Wright's proposal, where he proposed to break up the cities and have a scattering of dwellings with big buildings interspersed in it. The whole of the sort of eastern half of the United States turned into one mega suburb of more or less even density. But the way in which it's talked about and expressed is completely different. Frank Lloyd Wright's not quite as poetic as that, and he doesn't have it turning into flowers. He has it, and his driving force doesn't exist, which is that it works because of cars. This is a pre-cars. We hear nothing of people moving. People in this world, you get the sense, lead calm, communal lives. Sheerbart's point, in the glass thing, people will be, what is it?
They'll be calm and settled.
Yeah, these are calm and settled people. They don't move around.
They have discovered a new religion to sort of settle them, which is expressed in these glass buildings.
The worship of glass architecture that will unite everybody. There are three elements, right? There's land, there is a scattering of people across it, and they are focused by giant crystal churches.
People kind of become disaggregated and can no longer form themselves into big groups to fight each other. They become united, as he says, in this fog.
What he wants is a world where everything is aspiring to the single object of beauty. Yes. And he thinks that maybe nature will do it. He knows nothing about nature, never lived in the countryside, never does anything in the countryside. He's not compelled by these ideas to go and have a look at the countryside and would very quickly be disabused of some of his ideas if he went there. In Alpine architecture, it's crystals.
Yeah.
They are going to make this. The magical power of crystals and refracting glass is going to generate this, along with the Alps.
Yeah.
And there are other things. He's looking for the thing that will generate. He's looking for the justification. And if you read the sort of liner notes, you know, the notes that he puts with this, he puts in things like statistics about the number of people.
He puts in how many people can be fed from an acre of land.
Yeah, there's lots of rational statistic writing to justify all of this feels like searching for the path to... He's got a state that he wants, which is the masses all gathered round, huddled and tiny, looking up at a great crystal spire.
Yes.
With perhaps an architect on the top, perhaps glowing.
Yeah.
But it's the thing to be society.
It's the thing which they've all made together, though. As we've said, he's producing a lot of these, and they are by no means internally consistent with one another. Having talked about the dissolution of the cities, he then actually talks about an ideal form of the city in another work, The City Crown.
The City Crown is a different, slightly different beast. It's a proper essay book, which is mainly words, with photographic illustrations and a few drawings he's done. It doesn't have any ecstatic notions of architecture. And where he draws architecture, it looks a lot more like normal.
It's much more plausible. It's much more boxy. It's much less kind of diaphanous, ambiguously crystalline or vegetal. It looks much more convincingly like the work of human hands.
And it also looks like institutional.
Yes.
It looks like institutional buildings. And alongside it are images of pagodas and Greek temples and things like that.
Yeah, it's furnished with references.
But the book itself is a proposition, and it's a proposition for a new kind of garden city, or something like a garden city. It's a circle, and going in from the outside, you've got low densities of houses with gardens, and there's this network of roads, which are in vistas, and they go towards a centre, which has got the sort of industrial centre around it. And there are lots of the traditional ideas of garden cities, which is the separation of industry and work, and people have lots of space. But the key thing he brings is that in the centre of the city, there will be the city crown, which is like a cathedral, but he describes this as a sort of civil centre. In the centre, there's this great tower, but around that, you've got your opera houses and glass houses and places of entertainment, and sort of museums, but he doesn't really like objects in museums. He doesn't like art, thing to venerate.
There's only one kind of art, and it's the architecture of the city.
And you go, so you walk through your cascades of beautiful flowering gardens and aquaria, and then in the centre is the city crown itself, which is a giant tower. And he says, I haven't designed the architecture of it, but it is what everyone goes together to build. It is an object of outstanding beauty, and it is empty and purposeless. And it presides wherever you're in the city. It's like the Eye of Sauron. It's looking down on you, and you all gather together to build it, except that it's always there and complete. And it's completely empty, and it inspires you all to live together in harmony.
One thing to stress is that the city in this case is not like the communities shown in the other works. This is a big...
What is it, like a million person?
So in scale, it's comparable to the great cities of the day. The other thing is that he frames his argument in terms of looking to examples from history. And I want to read a short quotation. Throughout every great cultural epoch, the constructive will of the time was directed at one ulterior metaphysical building. The narrow concept of building construction applied today is a complete inversion of what it was in the past. A minster, a cathedral above a historic city, a pagoda above the huts of Indians, the enormous temple district in the square of the Chinese city, and the Acropolis above the simple houses of an ancient city, all show that the climax, the ultimate, is a crystallized religious conception. This is at once the starting point and the final goal for all architecture.
So, this is another vision of how he's going to create this world. What he's done is he's sort of taken the garden city, the Ebenezer Howard garden city, and he's taken the ecclesiastical German bishopric city and sort of squashed them together. So it's a garden city with a massive cathedral in the middle. But it's a cathedral to, when he says religion, he doesn't mean a particular religion. He means the religion of like social harmony and aesthetic beauty. Through this, everything will be harmonious. Everyone will, he says that because everyone will have their own place, everyone will be with people who are like them, and there will never be any arguments.
Yeah, the religion and the building are, I think, the same thing.
Everyone's going to worship architecture. He doesn't have a sense of an idea powering it. The idea is just building the big buildings. But it's funny because, like he never represents interiors, he also never represents the building. The way the cathedral city worked is you were building it for 100 years, And for that 100 years, the exercise was the building of it. He only describes it as completed, but in the perpetual state of being built. We can sort of, like, take the piss out of it and make lots of jokes out of it, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think we're sort of trying to understand it, but the...
You think this is the scary dystopian one. I think they're all the scary dystopian one.
Because in this one, he's actually in the business of trying to justify it, you get a much stronger sense of the way in which he really imagines an ideal world would work. And it's where some of the quite unattractive aspects of his view of human society really start to come out. And I think that these, one of the very obvious things is that in this world, not a lot of people get to be architects. And there's by no means a kind of equality between...
I suppose he's got two things. One of which is he loves everybody, but he loves architects most particularly. And the world is going to be very, very hierarchical. It's going to be a sort of pyramid. It's going to be like the hierarchy of building a cathedral. There's going to be architect at the top, Master Mason, and then there's going to be his cronies, people in charge of all that sort of stuff. And everyone is going to be able to express creativity, even if the extent of their possible imagination is colouring glass or something.
Yeah, no, even the humblest.
Yeah, it's got this William Morrissey, we're all going to express our creativity, we're all going to, like, no one's going to be alienated from their production.
And they're all going to be happy, but they're all going to very distinctly be in their
but
place.
But a lot of them are naturally betas and deltas and gammas.
Hal very much is, and I think this is slightly under-recognised, he's very much in a tradition of the architect as messiah.
Yes, he was very, very sad in the war because he thought, all these people are dying. Some of them could probably have been good architects.
It's documented. It's at, like, it's quite painful to read. He said something like, oh, 300,000 Frenchmen have died, and many among them will have been very talented, or something like that.
He was someone who, when he was designing buildings, was quite humane, and but he seems to have been unable to make the imaginative leap. Amazingly febrilely productive and amazingly unable to look at the implications of what he's saying.
To give an example of his humanity, an often cited one is the housing estate which he designed in Berlin, where there are something like 100 different front doors and all of them are designed uniquely. And it's so it means
and
that
every building's got its own like colour palette.
Yeah. Which is an extraordinary labour, and it's one which speaks to, like, this kind of wonderful
sort of
humanity.
It's also because he just liked designing doors.
Yeah, I think he loved designing things generally, but actually, like, that is a very humane gesture. That's, like, a very... There's something very attractive about that. I think that having a slightly partial view of this has led to a view in which Tout is frequently seen as significantly cuddlier and more humane version of other more abrasive modernist architects.
By which you mean... the international modern style of Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, and their chums. Most of those guys had theories that are not democratic and nice, and did buildings that were lovely, just like Tout. He did buildings that were nice and had madcap, extremist theories. Because he was someone who knew about buildings and didn't know about society, like all the other architects, and so could think through the consequences of building design, but not perhaps of society.
And we'll see in the next episode which kind of political positions and political actions that leads him to take up and where it gets him.
At the beginning, you're reading this stuff, so you're like, oh, this guy's really exciting. He's really not like the other people. I'd really like to learn more. And then you're like, this is very strange and curious. He's saying, society's going to be solved because of this strange reason. And then I can have another conservatory and I would like a bubbling pool. And then there's going to be this giant empty room. And because it's so empty, everyone is going to love it and be united in a religious ecstasy in this empty rectangle.
Under my authority.
Under my authority. But it's not. It's going to be one of those gentle authorities because they will finally realise, having never realised before, that I really deserved it. And they'll all see that, and then the next people down, that there'll be a natural sort of shaking up and a stratigraphy, and then all of the people will be in their place. And then we will live in harmony for eternity. And then you think this is insane, and maybe not very nice. And then you think all of this stuff was written incredibly quickly. He's in a desperate situation. He can't work. Whenever he could work and build buildings, Bruno Tout did that. There are many people whose writings have come down to us because they couldn't do what they really wanted to. Like Machiavelli couldn't get a proper job, so he wrote The Prince. There's lots of examples. Bruno Tout couldn't build the buildings that he wanted to. He couldn't implement his strategies through design. Before then, he'd been implementing his social beliefs, his sort of love for his fellow man, by building some social housing or designing pavilions or things. He can't do that, so he dashes these things off. It's a brief moment in his life, and it's the brief moment that we've all got for eternity. And after that, he goes back and sort of has various mixed successes doing more buildings. Yeah. And also, I feel that, as I was saying earlier, so much of it is ventriloquized. He's got an emotional sense about how he feels the relationship of man to aesthetics and production, which is that he feels the best thing is to do what he finds most enjoyable in life. He's someone who's really driven to design and make something that we can empathize with. You know, Etsy's doing very well. We all want to, like, how many people have thought, I mean, firstly, how many people say, oh, I would have loved to have been an architect? And how many also think, when I got some money, maybe I'll stop working in my office job and I'll have a farm, or I'll get to making those, like, wicker chairs.
Yeah.
And I can express myself through that and really feel good.
Yeah.
And that's what he thinks is the best thing that's going to draw us all together, this collective enterprise of production, which is something that's very easy to sympathise with. And then he's absorbing bits of the political culture of the time, trying to create a world in which that is the organising principle. Everyone gets to make nice things and live together in harmony. It's what we want, you know, it's what we desire. Maybe not everybody in the same way as him. And he has these thoughts, and then it's over.
Yeah.
It's such a brief thing. It's lovely to go through them, because you get a great sense of the time and the man and his human frailties. And just because someone's ideas are wrong and bad, have got bad elements, it doesn't mean that they come from a bad place.
No.
Or that they're not a worthy thing in the world, or that we shouldn't look at them. But having sort of got around them, I think I'm able to put the book back on the shelf.
I think that it does help to think about the position that these ideas are being formulated in emotional terms. He's imagining a world which is kind of half sort of medieval Christianity, but where Christianity is kind of replaced with what he thinks of as socialism, where he imagines this idea of kind of a mystic order and unity. He's casting around for sources of kind of stability, hope, these offers of a harmonious society in these quite diverse sort of places. That emotional state is where this strange hybrid of the city crown can come together. A socialist feudal society united around the geistig, spiritually unified pursuit altogether of beauty.
I'd like to talk about one more work, which I think in the canon would kind of be regarded as almost ephemeral. The Weltbaumeister, the world build master. Is that, yeah. Do you think that sort of works as a translation?
It's a difficult one. Weltworld, Bau, Build, Meister, Master. But however you put those together in a world that makes sense.
It's a very slight work. It's another picture book. And for me, it sums up both the course of the philosophy and my feeling about it in one place quite nicely. It's the storyboard to an architectural fantasy, a play laid on for a stage in two acts. And it's not even really buildings. It's things rising and falling out of space. And it is the reality of what he's driving at. The crystallizing and dissolving of things in and out of air, of wonder and mystery. He's not really driving at the city crown, those sort of blocky buildings with their aquaria and bingo halls or whatever. He's driving at rising of crystals, tendrils, plants, the crystal stars, the cathedrals whirling through space and darkness. Mist. Ecstasy.
A curtain opens. We see light. A mist out of which emerges a Gothic spire, wreathed in tendrils. Great flying buttresses rise, the mass of the building growing. We can see a vast rose window, a heart of glass, as we descend to face a huge opening, a cave-like portal. The walls to either side are mountainous buttresses. It opens, and we are in a forest of columns reaching up into light, colour. Overhead, arches, a lattice of fanning branches, and above them, it's glowing. Everything is glowing. A bell tolls.
It is as if rays of light are cutting into the stone. The arches and columns are being drawn up into the sky and coming apart.
Now separate, the column fragments are being drawn up in a great funnel of air, sweeping, separating, dissolving into an annihilating brightness. Blackness.
Stars emerge. Planets and meteors dance. Two stars approach, trailing light. Nearer. A crystal cathedral star, spinning, shining. It dances, leaving a trail of glittering dust. A meteor appears, shooting towards it. They collide. We see the forms of leaves.
Darkness over the water. Rain. Light. A rainbow. Summer light, and the surface has grown little hummocks and tiny houses. It is like the surface of moss or lichen. They grow, trees, barns, a garden city, covering the land to the horizon. And in the city, a glittering crystal crown. Shards and tongues of glass, and the stairs in front of us. Evening. The crystal house glows. Buttresses and spires are crystal. We are inside. Cascades of water spiral under a prismatic dome, the heart of the glass house, an inner wonder. Multicoloured light, diamond facets, glass orbs. The picture becomes still. The curtains close. Yes, that's it. That's everything in one place.
And in that moment of rapture, we're going to pause, but there's one more chapter of the story still to do. Yeah, drop us a line at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com, and we'll speak to you next time.
Live and love in the light of glass.